Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publication.
Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rance. Farmers across Western Canada are converging in Regina this week for Canada's Farm Progress Show. One of the big ideas they'll be hearing about is hemp, a crop that is so versatile it can be processed into thousands of different uses. However, a researcher with Northwest College in Alberta began investigating the potential for this crop, and she found all of that versatility comes with some complications for growers. Andrea Erickson is the Business Development Officer responsible for strategic initiatives at Northwest College. She traveled to farms across Western Canada, filming and interviewing farmers as part of her role to oversee development of a course for hemp farmers and processors. Andrea is joining me now to talk about what she learned. Hi, Andrea. So why were you studying hemp?
Well, in just outside of Edmonton, there's one of Canada and actually North America's first decortication facilities. So what that is a facility that can take the hemp stock and essentially break it into different components for entrepreneurial products. So because of this, there was this interest in the region to find out more about what hemp can do, how can you grow hemp for a fiber application, and that spurred us to do a little bit more investigation and build a curriculum around how to farm it and then how to make products from it.
Now, how many products can you make out of hemp?
They say you can make over 10,000 different products from hemp. You can do basically as much as you can get the supply for, essentially.
Really?
You can make products that are from the flowering head, so that's cannabidiol-based products that could be cosmetic applications or food applications in the future with the Health Canada regulations coming out. You can do products that are from the stock of the hemp plant, so that would be building products like hempcrete for hemp homes, or from the bast that's on the outer part of the hemp stock, which could be for textiles or even some plastic composites. Really well known in Canada, the food products have really led the way. There's a lot of applications such as hemp seed oil and also hemp protein powder, and they're starting to actually use the hemp seed oil to make those clear plastic bottles that you see. And then the roots can be used for heavy metal remediation. So it's quite a versatile crop.
Wow. So what were some of the key points that you learned when talking to growers and the industry about the crop?
The big thing with growers is it's a little bit of a different crop than what they're used to, because it's not like they can go to a centralized place and sell their crop. They're having to negotiate with a lot of these end businesses that are selling to consumers. So each of those businesses have a different seeding rate specification, a different harvest time specification, and also some recommendations around fertilizer levels. So if, for example, you're looking for a seed application, you want to grow throughout the growing season and have cultivars that are essentially lower to the ground and maximizing the number of leaves and flowering heads that are produced, versus a textile application, your seeding density is going to be a little bit more. You're going to want to have a lot more biomass created, a lot more crowding of the plots so that the stalks grow taller, and so it's definitely a different approach based on what end product that you're looking to sell for.
So it's not a crop that you necessarily grow on spec then. You practically have to have a contracted place or some market in place before you can decide how to grow it?
Exactly, yeah. And each business that you contract with will have different growing specs based on what they know that their end customer wants. You see a lot of a trend right now, especially in the hemp heart market for organic production.
Right.
And a lot of farmers are conventional, and they're like, oh, why do we have to go organic? But a lot of that's being driven by customer demand. So it's really interesting. And then different companies, of course, have different methods for the organic production. So, yeah, you definitely have to do a lot of research and have that contract in place before you get going.
Is it worthwhile?
It's definitely worthwhile. So what a lot of farmers are finding is there's the opportunity for these dual purpose crops. So in the past, there was really only the ability for farmers to farm for grain, but now you're seeing farmers doing dual crops like grain plus cannabidiol extraction. So then they can get kind of the two revenue streams from that. You're seeing farmers go for cannabidiol and also fiber crops and getting the biomass. I looked up some of the current prices of what farmers are getting before this call, and it looks like in 2019 seeds are contracted for $0.5 to $0.6 a pound for conventional, right, and about $1.30 a pound for organic. And then for the bast fiber, that's the what they make for textiles. It's about $1,800 a ton of bast and about $600 a ton for herd. And then for CBD, it's really the Wild West because there it's just an emerging. And basically, like, it was, you were allowed to harvest it last year, but you're not allowed really to process it until the new regulations come in the okay. fall. But some of the dollar values that we're seeing could be up to $10 a pound, but it is the Wild West in terms of the price. So it's really about contacting those companies that are looking to get that product from you.
So, you know, a producer has to know the market that they're aiming for, and they have to be able to produce according to those specifications. Is the crop, generally speaking, a difficult crop to grow compared to other crops they might have in their rotation?
Yeah, so it definitely has, because it's a very strong fiber, it has a really strong tensile strength, which makes it, you know, advantageous for using in like automotive parts as a composite. That does come with some challenges when you're combining it. You definitely have to watch for wrapping.
Right.
That there isn't wrapping of the stock. So there's some considerations with combine modifications. As well, moisture content when you harvest is really important. So ensuring that you're harvesting within 12 to 16% moisture content, because if farmers kind of leave it too long, what can happen are fires, actually. And so really with hemp, you're kind of wanting to harvest a little bit of a higher moisture content. And then for a seed market, for example, getting it dried and stored and kind of within the next couple of hours so that there's no spoilage of seed. So as long as people know that and there's the awareness, they'll be okay. But it's kind of because there's been no curriculum and no standard education around what to do. It's all been by word of mouth. With what farmers should do with the harvest methodology and the combine modifications.
I guess a lot of lessons learned the hard way.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What do you have any idea of just how many acres we're growing of hemp in Canada now and what the future might be for this crop?
Yeah, so I'll just double check what the unit of measurement is. But I can tell you that out of Alberta, there are 335 industrial hemp licenses, in Manitoba, 202, and then in Saskatchewan, 294 hemp licenses. So you definitely see that the prairie provinces have the most amount of licenses that they're gathering, and there is projection for more. And a lot of, with the industry, a lot will be driven by essentially having these dual-purpose crops. So the abilities for farmers to take a hemp plant and have somewhere to sell the seeds, somewhere to sell the CBD, and somewhere to sell the components of the stock will really help to have the industry take off and more demand to produce.
So we're really seeing a small small cluster of producers in each of these provinces now that is looking or working with this crop. But do you see any, you see a fairly big potential then for more farmers to get involved with this industry? The demand seems to be there.
Yeah, and I did have a good conversation with a provincial rep in Manitoba, and he was saying that a lot of the hemp growing in Manitoba is currently happening in Parklands area,
right?
Around the Dauphin
Correct.
Area,
yeah.
And there's a lot of kind of fiber and decortication capabilities, and there's actually a co-op, the Parkland Industrial Hemp Growers Co-op, that's playing a pivotal role in helping farmers band together and also with negotiations on some of these different prices and deals with producers. So that's something that's unique in Manitoba too. The main place for seed, selling seeds, is of course Manitoba Harvest. They're very well known. But then the other two players that are interested in a lot of contracts that are getting press in Manitoba would be HempSense. And so they're basically taking stock, you know, and they're doing CBD-based products, some pet food products, absorbents. And then the other company is Plains Industrial Hemp Processing Limited. And so they're doing hemp herd, horse bedding, some hempcrete blocks, barbecue pellets. So you see that there is a bit of a cluster in Manitoba and places to sell, and the seed growing activities are happening around the Winnipeg area more, and then fiber, of course, in the Parklands region.
Whoa, there's just a lot happening in that sector right now. Well, thanks very much, Andrea, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on the call. I'm looking forward to speaking at the Farm Progress Show and sharing some of the pictures that we've taken of farmers in the field.
Well, that's great. We'll catch up with you again just to follow through down the road. That was Andrea Erickson, Business Development Officer with Northwest College in Edmonton. She's in Regina this week talking to farmers attending Canada's Outdoor Farm Show. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rantz. It's no secret to anyone in agriculture that good help is hard to find. In fact, primary agriculture is considered to have the highest job vacancy rate of any sector in the Canadian economy. The Country Guide's Lorraine Stevenson has been looking into this problem lately. She's here to talk about how big the problem is and how some farmers are finding ways to address it. Hi, Lorraine. Welcome to Between the Rows.
Hello, Laura.
First of all, in your recent article in the Guide, you indicated that this problem is escalating. How many jobs are going unfilled in agriculture today, and how is that number expected to change in the future?
Well, what we know right now from the work that's been done by the Canadian Agricultural Human Resource Council, work that was done in 2014, is that the labor shortage is projected to be at 114,000 workers by 2025. And when that work was done, there were 59,000 more jobs than workers to fill them. So again, in 2014, we're going to soon have some updates to all of those numbers. The Canadian Agricultural Human Resource Council has been working with the Conference Board of Canada on a labor market information survey that will update those numbers to 2029. So I haven't seen any of the new numbers yet, but what I am hearing is that the shortage was acute in 2014. It's not expected to look any better, and probably quite a bit worse in 10 years.
That's almost a doubling of the gap. Why is it so hard to find workers on the farm?
Well, farmers are caught in that quandary of offering what is often only seasonal work in a place, in parts of the country where few people live. So mainly the barriers are seasonal nature of work offered and the fact that farms are in rural areas. And on top of that, there are more retirees all the time, including among farmers themselves. There are issues, no doubt, related to transition planning on the farm that create uncertainty for family members who might otherwise be groomed to take over the farm. Rural Canada has been exporting its young people. The proportion of Canadians living in rural Canada has dropped to fewer than one in five.
So there's a lot of factors in play here, which just complicates the whole issue.
Indeed, there are.
So what options do farmers have?
Well, the story that I wrote in the Country Guide took a bit of a look into the growing interest among farmers in the federal temporary foreign worker program. And as well, the story kind of looks at how that program might be honed better to meet the needs of agricultural workers, the needs of agricultural employers. So right now, the options farmers have are the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program. That's a program that's been around for many years, and the fruit and vegetable industry make use of it widely. You have a program called the Agricultural Stream, but then there's also low-wage and high-wage streams within the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. So there are just a lot of different potential programs and processes that farmers could be going through to hire workers through the Temporary Foreign Worker Program, but they do find it very complicated to navigate.
There's been a couple of new initiatives lately announced to help address the issue. What are the details around those?
Yeah, well, I would just say in advance is that there's a lot of attention getting focused on this. We had the Canadian Agriculture and Agri-Food Workforce Action Plan putting forward a series of recommendations, and they include streamlining the processes within the current temporary foreign work program as a shorter-term solution, and then creating a more dedicated program to match agricultural-specific needs to immigration as a more permanent, longer-term fix. So some of the things that have been happening recently are the Canadian Agricultural Human Resource Council has been undertaking a series of workshops across Canada to help farmers, agricultural employers, better understand how to hire workers from offshore to supplement their Canadian workforce. And Canadian Human Resource Councils, they've developed employer guides and handbooks, and those are now available on their website. And in the works federally right now is the new Agri-Food Immigration Program. That was announced in the 2019 budget, and that's aiming at helping more non-seasonal foreign agri-workers brought to Canada through the Temporary Foreign Worker Program gain permanent residency. So instead of having to continuously renew their work permits, they could stay here. And that's been really applauded by the meat processing industry because they've been asking for something like that for years. And they have a very widely well-documented shortage of cutters, and they're also providing year-round permanent jobs. There's also been a couple of other initiatives recently announced. The Federal Rural and Northern Immigration Pilot is intended to link economic development groups together with rural communities. And then there's been a program for, I think it's just under $4 million rolled out to attract young people into agricultural jobs.
Right.
But I think the number I saw was that that's going to create about 200 jobs.
Yes.
So not really even scratching the surface. But I think overall what's hoped for is that once these projects and these pilots are executed and we learn something from them, that there may be a more dedicated and concentrated approach to addressing the employment needs in agriculture.
Your article kind of zeroed in on how one farmer addressed the issue, and it turns out he didn't go through any of the conventional ways. It was
right.
It was really a conversation. Can you tell us a little bit about how that unfolded?
Yeah, I started that story describing how a farm owner in Manitoba found two very good staff, including one who is a qualified mechanic. And he did so simply by making the acquaintance of a small town business owner. The owner had a local convenience store, and he turned out to have an agricultural degree himself that he had earned in India. He had obviously chosen a different course for his life, but he'd come to Canada, had brought some family here, and had two nephews interested in working on Canadian farms. So these two young men got to know the Manitoba farmer and asked for jobs on the farm, and it's apparently worked out very well. You don't often hear stories like that. I would hope to hear more of them. And I simply highlighted that because it, to me, it seemed like a great example of a farmer living in a community and building relationships and friendships with that community's newcomer population.
That's a really cool story. Thanks for sharing it with us.
You're very welcome, Laura. Thank you.
That was Lorraine Stevenson, Associate Editor of The Country Guide. This is Between the Rows. I'm Laura Rance. Well, many parts of the prairie saw some rain this week, which had everyone who has crops in the ground heaving a huge sigh of relief. And as we were recording this podcast, there was more in the forecast. That's injecting some badly needed optimism into prospects for yields in Western Canada. However, farmers in Ontario and south of the border aren't as happy to see those storm clouds. Joining me now is Bruce Burnett, Glacier Farm Media's Glacier Farm Media's Director of Weather and Markets Information, to talk about what this combination of rain and too much rain could mean for Canadian farmers. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to Between the Rows.
Hi.
So, first of all, how much good has the rain we've seen so far done?
Well, we certainly needed some rain in a lot of areas just to get germination evened out. And the crops seem to, even the crops that germinated seem to stall out because they couldn't reach the moisture if there was any moisture. So these certainly are good rains. But again, as we've been stressing throughout this spring, we need more rain and consistent rain throughout this growing season. So although these rains are nice, in another couple of weeks, there will be people looking for some more moisture.
So we're really not out of the woods yet when it comes to soil moisture conditions in Western Canada.
No, not really. Alberta has some better moisture conditions, especially up in the northern growing areas. I would say the same thing in northern Saskatchewan. On the northwestern side, we have a little bit better subsoil moisture, but really most areas of the prairies don't have a lot of reserve there to fall back on if we do get into a hot, dry stretch this summer.
So how does what's happening here compare to the situation south of the border and in Ontario?
Well, certainly it's probably far more dire in the south, in the U.S. as well as in southern Ontario, because of the fact that farmers haven't been able to plant. So at least in Western Canada, we managed to plant the crop, although the germination wasn't good. In these areas, it's just been too wet to plant. And so we've seen, again, the typical things when we get into wet seeding conditions. Portions of fields can't be planted. There's flooding going on. And really the general health of the corn crop, although it's rated really well, is not all that good because it hasn't gotten off to a very good start in the U.S.
I'm seeing some reports that there could be significant acres that aren't planted at all in the U.S. What kind of numbers are you seeing there?
Well, certainly if you take a look at the USDA data and the forecast as we speak here in the middle of June, certainly we could see numbers north of 10 million acres not planted in the Corn Belt in the two major crops. Now, again, it just depends a lot on how the weather evolves here. And as we all know, forecasts are not quite that reliable, but certainly it's going to be a push for a lot of farmers in southern Ontario as well as in the U.S. Corn Belt to get this crop planted.
What might that mean for prices? I mean, I saw reports this morning of corn futures hitting a five-year high. I mean, you know, what's the outlook looking now, and how big of a turnaround is that from a few weeks ago?
Well, it's certainly a dramatic turnaround because what we saw was the market felt that things were okay all the way up until about the middle of May when we hit sort of the recent lows. And then people suddenly seemed to realize, oh, this is really, really late planting. It's probably not going to be good for the crop. And so then we saw this large move upwards. And as you say, we're hitting five-year highs in terms of the futures price. Depending on how much acreage is lost, I think the biggest factor in this, though, is actually going to be the yields, because late planting, especially for a long season crop like corn, really does bite into the yields. And even without an early frost, you can see significant yield reductions because the plant just basically doesn't have enough growing degree days through the crop season to produce a normal yield.
I think a lot of people thought, well, if they're not planting corn, they'll just switch over to soybeans. But that may not happen either then, from the sounds of it.
Well, that's right. Again, we have in the latest USDA report, 92% of the corn planted. So you have 8% of the corn area that's available to plant into soybeans, which is nice in theory. But again, it's still wet. And soybeans, you can plant them later. But again, you need some dry conditions to get those soybeans planted, and it doesn't look like there's going to be too many breaks here over the next 2 weeks in the U.S. Corn Belt and into southern Ontario.
Does a boost in the corn and soybean prices automatically mean a bump up for Canadian wheat and canola then?
Well, it's certainly helpful, and we've seen canola rally and wheat rally as well to some extent. Again, the dynamics in the oilseed complex and the wheat complex are a little bit different, especially on the wheat side, because you have large supplies. We're getting into harvest season, but even there, we're seeing some of the effects of rains down in the southern plains. Winter wheat harvest is only 2% done, and only 1% in Kansas at this point in time. Normally, they're up in the double digits already, and the harvest moving along. It doesn't look like it's going to get a break in that region either. So
I also noticed that the Australians have just downgraded their export projections for wheat by 18% because of drought. So we could see a bit of a difference in terms of the supply demand for wheat then, would we?
Yes. I think, again, the Australian dryness, it's in their planting season and in the slow growth period during their Australian winter, but it is critical that they get some rains. I would say that one of the problems with the wheat market, though, is we're starting into the harvest period, and certainly the Russian harvest and the European harvests look like they're going to be certainly larger than last year, maybe significantly larger than last year. So that's going to create some changes there in terms of the dynamics in the wheat market. But generally speaking, because of the corn base and being at a relatively high price, that is going to be supportive for the wheat markets globally.
So what should farmers here keep an eye on over the next few weeks? Are there definitely some pricing opportunities for them?
Well, again, because we've had the rains now, it's something to take a look at. I would say, especially in these types of weather markets, it's useful to start pricing some of your commodities for next year if conditions are good on your farm. I think, again, just be very mindful that the situation here in Western Canada could change around rather rapidly as well. So, and most farmers know you don't count your chickens before they hatch, right?
Yeah, at least that in theory.
In theory.
Thanks for joining us, Bruce.
Thanks.
Bruce Burnett is Director of Weather and Markets Information for Glacier Farm Media. That's all we have for you on this week's Between the Rows, but we'll be back again next week. Thanks for joining us. I'm Laura Rance.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.